Is it dead, do you think? It looks dead. It's not. Sleeping, maybe, but a long way from dead. You sure? Were you sure it would be pink? It wasn't a question he had to answer, and he didn't. The face she turned up to him was strained and badly frightened. It's sleeping, and you know what? I'm scared to wake it up. Well, we'll wait for the others, then. She shook her head. I think we better try to be ready for when they get here, because I've got an idea that they're going to come on the run. Push me over to that box mounted on the bars. It looks like an intercom. See it? He did, and pushed her slowly toward it. It was mounted on one side of a closed gate in the center of the barrier which ran the length of the cradle. The vertical bars of the barrier were made of what looked like stainless steel. Those of the gate appeared to be ornamental iron, and their lower ends disappeared into steel-ringed holes in the floor. There was no way either of them was going to wiggle through those bars either, Eddie saw. The gap between each set was no more than 4 inches. It would have been a tight squeeze even for Oi. Pigeons ruffled and cooed overhead. The left wheel of Susanna's chair squawked monotonously. My kingdom for an oil can, Eddie thought, and realized he was a lot more than just scared. The last time he had felt this level of terror had been on the day when he and Henry had stood on the sidewalk of Reinhold Street in Dutch Hill, looking at the slumped ruin of the mansion. They hadn't gone in on that day in 1977. They had turned their backs on the haunted house and walked away, and he remembered vowing to himself that he would never, never, ever go back to that place. It was a promise he'd kept, but here he was, in another haunted house, and there was the haunter, right over there, Blaine the Mono, a long, low, pink shape with one window peering at him like the eye of a dangerous animal who is shamming sleep. He stirs no more from his birth in the cradle. He has even stopped speaking in his many voices and laughing. Artis was the last to go nigh Blaine, and when Artis couldn't answer what was asked, Blaine slew him with blue fire. If it speaks to me, I'll probably go crazy, Eddie thought. The wind gusted outside, and a fine spray of rain flew in through the tall egress slot cut in the side of the building. He saw it strike Blaine's window and beat up there. Eddie shuddered suddenly and looked sharply around. We're being watched. I can feel it. I wouldn't be at all surprised. Push me closer to the gate, Eddie. I want to get a better look at that box. Okay, but don't touch it if it's electrified. If Blaine wants to cook us, he will, Susanna said, looking through the bars at Blaine's back. You know it, and I do too. And because Eddie knew that was only the truth, he said nothing. The box looked like a combination intercom and burglar alarm. There was a speaker set into the top half with what looked like a talk-listen button next to it. Below this were numbers arranged in a shape which made a diamond. Under the diamond were two other buttons with words of the high speech printed on them, Command and Enter. Susanna looked bewildered and doubtful. What is this thing, do you think? It looks like a gadget in a science fiction movie. Of course it did, Eddie realized. Susanna had probably seen a home security system or two in her time. She had, after all, lived among the Manhattan rich, even if she had not been very enthusiastically accepted by them. But there was a world of difference between the electronics gear available in her when, 1963, and his own, which was 1987. We've never talked much about the differences either, he thought. I wonder what she'd think if I told her Ronald Reagan was president of the United States when Roland snatched me. Probably that I was crazy. It's a security system, he said. Then, although his nerves and instincts screamed out against it, he forced himself to reach out with his right hand and thumb the talk-listen switch. There was no crackle of electricity, no deadly blue fire went racing up his arm, no sign that the thing was even still connected. Maybe Blaine is dead. Maybe he's dead after all. But he didn't really believe that. Hello? He said, and in his mind's eye saw the unfortunate artist screaming as he was microwaved by the blue fire dancing all over his face and body, melting his eyes and setting his hair ablaze. Hello, Blaine? Anybody? He let go of the button and waited, stiff with tension. Susanna's hand crept into his, cold and small. There was still no answer, and Eddie, now more reluctant than ever, pushed the button again. "Blaine?" He let go of the button, waited, and when there was still no answer, a dangerous giddiness overcame him, as it often did in moments of stress and fear. When that giddiness took him, counting the cost no longer seemed to matter. Nothing mattered. It had been like that when he had outfaced Balazar's sallow-faced contact man in Nassau, and it was like that now. And if Roland had seen him in the moment this lunatic impatience overtook him, he would have seen more than just a resemblance between Eddie and Cuthbert. He would have sworn Eddie was Cuthbert. He jammed the button in with his thumb and began to bellow into the speaker, adopting a plummy and completely bogus British accent. "Hello, blind, cheerio, old fellow. This is Robin Leach, host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Brainless, here to tell you that you have won $6 billion and a new Ford Escort in the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes." Pigeons took flight above them in soft, startled explosions of wings. Susanna gasped. Her face wore the dismayed expression of a devout woman who has just heard her husband blaspheme in a cathedral.
"Eddie, stop it! Stop it!"
Eddie couldn't stop it. His mouth was smiling, but his eyes glittered with a mixture of fear, hysteria, and frustrated anger.
"You and your monorail girlfriend, Patricia, will spend a luxurious month in scenic Jimtown, where you'll drink only the finest wine and eat only the finest virgins. You sh—"
Eddie broke off, looking at Susanna. He was at once sure that it had been she who had shushed him, not only because she had already tried, but because she was the only other person here. And yet at the same time he knew it hadn't been Susanna. That had been another voice, the voice of a very young and very frightened child. "Sus, did you—" Susanna was shaking her head and raising her hand at the same time. She pointed at the intercom box, and Eddie saw the button marked Command was glowing a very faint shell pink. It was the same color as the mono sleeping in its berth on the other side of the barrier.
"Shh, don't wake him up,"
the child's voice mourned. It drifted from the speaker, soft as an evening breeze. "What?" Eddie began. Then he shook his head, reached toward the talk listen switch, and pressed it gently. When he spoke again, it was not in the blaring Robin Leach bellow, but in the almost whisper of a conspirator.
"What are you? Who are you?"
He released the button. He and Susanna regarded each other with the big eyes of children who now know they are sharing the house with a dangerous, perhaps psychotic, adult. How have they come by the knowledge? Why, because another child has told them, a child who has lived with a psychotic adult for a long time, hiding in corners and stealing out only when it knows the adult is asleep, a frightened child who happens to be almost invisible. There was no answer. Eddie let the seconds spin out. Each one seemed long enough to read a whole novel in. He was reaching for the button again when the faint pink glow reappeared.
"I'm little Blaine,"
the child's voice whispered.
"The one he doesn't see. The one he forgot. The one he thinks he left behind in the rooms of ruin and the halls of the dead."
Eddie pushed the button again with a hand that had picked up an uncontrollable shake. He could hear that shake in his voice as well.
Who is the one who doesn't see? Is it the bear?"
No, not the bear, not he. Shardik lay dead in the forest, many miles behind them. The world had moved on, even since then. Eddie suddenly remembered what it had been like to lay his ear against that strange, unfound door in the clearing where the bear had lived its violent half-life, that door with its somehow terrible stripes of yellow and black. It was all of a piece, he realized now, all part of some awful decaying whole, a tattered web with the dark tower at its center like an incomprehensible stone spider. All of Midworld had become one vast haunted mansion in these strange latter days. All of Midworld had become the drawers. All of Midworld had become a wasteland, haunting and haunted. He saw Susanna's lips form the words of the real answer before the voice from the intercom could speak them, and those words were as obvious as the solution to a riddle once the answer is spoken.
Big Blaine,
the unseen voice whispered.
Big Blaine is the ghost in the machine, the ghost in all the machines.
Susanna's hand had gone to her throat and was clutching it as if she intended to strangle herself. Her eyes were full of terror, but they were not glassy, not stunned. They were sharp with understanding. Perhaps she knew a voice like this one from her own Wen, the Wen where the integrated whole that was Susanna had been shunted aside by the warring personalities of Detta and Odetta. The childish voice had surprised her as well as him, but her agonized eyes said she was no stranger to the concept being expressed. Susanna knew all about the madness of duality.
"Eddie, we have to go," she said.
Her terror turned the words into an unpunctuated auditory smear. He could hear air whistling in her windpipe like a cold wind around a chimney.
"Eddie, we have to get away! Eddie, we have to get away! Eddie, too late!"
the tiny mourning voice said.
"He's awake! Big Blaine is awake! He knows you are here, and he's coming!"
Suddenly lights, bright orange arc sodiums, began to flash on in pairs above them, bathing the pillared vastness of the cradle in a harsh glare that banished all shadows. Hundreds of pigeons darted and swooped in frightened, aimless flight, startled from their complex of interlocked nests high above. "Wait!" Eddie shouted. "Please, wait!" In his agitation, he forgot to push the button, but it made no difference. Little Blaine responded anyway.
"No, I can't let him catch me. I can't let him kill me, too."
The light on the intercom box went dark again, but only for a moment. This time both command and enter lit up, and their color was not pink, but the lurid dark red of a blacksmith's forge.
"Who are you?"
a voice roared, and it came not just from the box, but from every speaker in the city which still operated. The rotting bodies hanging from the poles shivered with the vibrations of that mighty voice. It seemed that even the dead would run from Blaine if they could. Susanna shrank back in her chair, the heels of her hands pressed to her ears, her face long with dismay, her mouth distorted in a silent scream. Eddie felt himself shrinking toward all the fantastic, hallucinatory terrors of 11. Had it been this voice he had feared when he and Henry stood outside the mansion, that he had perhaps even anticipated? He didn't know. But he did know how Jack in that old story must have felt when he realized that he had tried the beanstalk once too often and awakened the giant.
"How dare you disturb my sleep? Tell me now, or die where you stand."
He might have frozen right there, leaving Blaine, Big Blaine, to do to them whatever it was he had done to Artis, or something even worse. Perhaps should have frozen, locked in that down-the-rabbit-hole fairy-tale terror. It was the memory of the small voice which had spoken first that enabled him to move. It had been the voice of a terrified child, but it had tried to help them, terrified or not. "So now you have to help yourself," he thought. "You woke it up. Deal with it, for Christ's sake." Eddie reached out and pushed the button again.
"My name is Eddie Dean. The woman with me is my wife, Susanna.
He looked at Susanna, who nodded and made frantic motions for him to go on.
"We're on a quest. We seek the Dark Tower, which lies in the path of the beam. We're in the company of two others, Roland of Gilead and Jake of New York. We're from New York, too. If you're..."
He paused for a moment, biting back the words Big Blaine. If he used them, he might make the intelligence behind the voice aware that they had heard another voice, a ghost inside the ghost, so to speak. Susanna gestured again for him to go on, using both hands.
"If you're Blaine the Mono, well, we want you to take us."
He released the button. There was no response for what seemed like a very long time, only the agitated flutter of the disturbed pigeons from overhead. When Blaine spoke again, his voice came only from the speaker box mounted on the gate and sounded almost human. "Do not try my patience. All the doors to that ware are closed. Gilead is no more, and those known as gunslingers are all dead. Now answer my question. Who are you? This is your last chance." There was a sizzling sound. A ray of brilliant blue-white light lanced down from the ceiling and seared a hole the size of a golf ball in the marble floor less than 5 feet to the left of Susanna's wheelchair. Smoke that smelled like the aftermath of a lightning bolt rose lazily from it. Susanna and Eddie stared at each other in mute terror for a moment, and then Eddie lunged for the communicator box and thumbed the button.
"You're wrong. We did come from New York. We came through the doors on the beach only a few weeks ago."
"It's true," Susanna called. "I swear it is."
Silence. Beyond the long barrier, Blaine's pink back humped smoothly. The window at the front seemed to regard them like a vapid glass eye. The wiper could have been a lid half-closed in a sly wink.
"Prove it," Blaine said at last.
"Christ, how do I do that?" Eddie asked Susanna.
"I don't know."
Eddie pushed the button again.
"The Statue of Liberty. Does that ring a bell?"
"Go on," Blaine said. Now the voice sounded almost thoughtful.
"The Empire State Building, the Stock Exchange, the World Trade Center, Coney Island Red Hots, Radio City Music Hall, the East Villa—"
Blaine cut him off. And now, incredibly, the voice which came from the speaker was the drawling voice of John Wayne.
"Okay, Pilgrim, I believe you."
Eddie and Susanna shared another glance, this one of confusion and relief. But when Blaine spoke again, the voice was again cold and emotionless. "Ask me a question, Eddie Dean of New York, and it better be a good one." There was a pause, and then Blaine added, "Because if it's not, you and your woman are going to die, no matter where you came from." Susanna looked from the box on the gate to Eddie.
"What's it talking about?"
she hissed. Eddie shook his head.
"I don't have the slightest idea."
28. To Jake, the room Gasher dragged him into looked like a Minuteman missile silo which had been decorated by the inmates of a lunatic asylum. Part museum, part living room, part hippie crash pad. Above him, empty space vaulted up to a rounded ceiling, and below him it dropped 75 or 100 feet to a similarly rounded base. Running all around the single curved wall in vertical lines were tubes of neon in alternating strokes of color: red, blue, green, yellow, orange, peach, pink. These long tubes came together in roaring rainbow knots at the bottom and top of the silo, if that was what it had been. The room was about three-quarters of the way up the vast capsule-shaped space and floored with rusty iron grillwork. Rugs that looked Turkish, he later learned that such rugs were actually from a barony called Kashmin, lay on the grilled floor here and there. Their corners were held down with brass-bound trunks or standing lamps or the squat legs of overstuffed chairs. If not, they would have flapped like strips of paper tied to an electric fan, because a steady warm draft rushed up from below. Another draft, this one issuing from a circular band of ventilators like the ones in the tunnel they had followed here, swirled about 4 or 5 feet above Jake's head. On the far side of the room was a door identical to the one through which he and Gasher had entered, and Jake assumed it was a continuation of the subterranean corridor following the path of the beam. There were half a dozen people in the room, 4 men and 2 women. Jake guessed that he was looking at the Gray High Command, if, that was, there were enough Grays left to warrant a High Command. None of them were young, but all were still in the prime of their lives. They looked at Jake as curiously as he looked at them. Sitting in the center of the room, with one massive leg thrown casually over the arm of a chair big enough to be a throne, was a man who looked like a cross between a Viking warrior and a giant from a child's fairy tale. His heavily muscled upper body was naked except for a silver band around one bicep, a knife scabbard looped over one shoulder, and a strange charm about his neck. His lower body was clad in soft, tight-fitting leather breeches, which were tucked into high boots. He wore a yellow scarf tied around one of these. His hair, a dirty gray-blonde, cascaded almost to the middle of his broad back. His eyes were as green and curious as the eyes of a tomcat who is old enough to be wise, but not old enough to have lost that refined sense of cruelty which passes for fun in feline circles. Hung by its strap from the back of the chair was what looked like a very old machine gun. Jake looked more closely at the ornament on the Viking's chest and saw that it was a coffin-shaped glass box hung on a silver chain. Inside it, a tiny gold clock face marked the time at 5 minutes past 3. Below the face, a tiny gold pendulum went back and forth, and despite the soft whoosh of circulating air from above and below, he could hear the tick-tock sound it made. The hands of the clock were moving faster than they should have done, and Jake was not very surprised to see that they were moving backward. He thought of the crocodile in Peter Pan, the one that was always chasing after Captain Hook, and a little smile touched his lips. Gasher saw it and raised his hand. Jake cringed away, putting his own hands to his face. The tick-tock man shook his finger at Gasher in an amusing schoolmarmish gesture.
Now, no need of that, Gasher, he said.
Gasher lowered his hand at once. His face had changed completely. Before, it had alternated between stupid rage and a species of cunning, almost existential humor. Now he only looked servile and adoring. Like the others in the room, and Jake himself, the Gasher man could not look away from Tick-Tock for long. His eyes were drawn inexorably back. And Jake could understand why. The Tick-Tock man was the only person here who seemed wholly vital, wholly healthy, and wholly alive.
"If you say there's no need, there ain't," Gasher said.
But he favored Jake with a dark look before shifting his eyes back to the blonde giant on the throne.
"Still, he's very pert, Tickie, very pert indeed, so he is. And if you want my opinion, he'll take a deal of training."
"When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it," the Tick-Tock man said. "Now close the door, Gash, was you born in a barn?"
A dark-haired woman laughed shrilly, a sound like the caw of a crow. Tick-Tock flicked his eyes toward her. She quieted at once and cast her eyes down to the grilled floor. The door through which Gasher had dragged him was actually two doors. The arrangement reminded Jake of the way spaceship airlocks looked in the more intelligent science fiction movies. Gasher shut them both and turned to Tick-Tock, giving him a thumbs-up gesture. The Tick-Tock man nodded and reached languidly up to press a button set into a piece of furniture that looked like a speaker's podium. A pump began to cycle wheezily within the wall, and the neon tubes dimmed perceptibly. There was a faint hiss of air, and the valve wheel of the inside door spun shut. Jake supposed the one in the outer door was doing the same. This was some sort of bomb shelter, all right, no doubt of that. When the pump died, the long neon tubes resumed their former muted brilliance.
"There," Tick-Tock said pleasantly.
His eyes began to look Jake up and down. Jake had a clear and very uncomfortable sense of being expertly catalogued and filed.
"All safe and sound we are. Snug as bugs in a rug, right, Hoots?"
"We are,"
a tall, skinny man in a black suit replied promptly. His face was covered with some sort of rash, which he scratched obsessively.
"I brung him," Gasher said. "I told you could trust me to do it, and didn't I?"
"You did," Tick-Tock said. "Bang on. I had some doubts about your ability to remember the password at the end there," but the dark-haired woman uttered another shrill caw.
The Tick-Tock man half turned in her direction, that lazy smile dimpling the corners of his mouth, and before Jake was able to grasp what was happening, what had already happened, she was staggering backward, her eyes bulging in surprise and pain, her hands groping at some strange tumor in the middle of her chest, which hadn't been there a second before. Jake realized the Tick-Tock man had made some sort of move as he was turning, a move so quick it had been no more than a flicker. The slim white hilt which had protruded from the scabbard looped over the Tick-Tock man's shoulder was gone. The knife was now on the other side of the room, sticking out of the dark-haired woman's chest. Tick-Tock had drawn and thrown with an uncanny speed Jake wasn't sure even Roland could match. It had been like some malign magic trick. The others watched silently as the woman staggered toward Tick-Tock, gagging harshly, her hands wrapped loosely around the hilt of the knife. Her hip bumped one of the standing lamps, and the one called Hoots darted forward to catch it before it could fall. Tick-Tock himself never moved. He only went on sitting with his leg tossed over the arm of his throne, watching the woman with his lazy smile. Her foot caught beneath one of the rugs, and she tumbled forward. Once more the Tick-Tock man moved with that spooky speed, pulling back the foot which had been dangling over the arm of the chair, and then driving it forward again like a piston. It buried itself in the pit of the dark-haired woman's stomach, and she went flying backward. Blood spewed from her mouth and splattered the furniture. She struck the wall, slid down it, and ended up sitting with her chin on her breastbone. To Jake, she looked like a movie Mexican taking a siesta against an adobe wall. It was hard for him to believe she had gone from living to dead with such terrible speed. Neon tubes turned her hair into a haze that was half red and half blue. Her glazing eyes stared at the TikTok man with terminal amazement. "I told her about that laugh," TikTok said. His eyes shifted to the other woman, a heavy-set redhead who looked like a long-haul trucker. "Didn't I, Tilly?"
"Aye,"
Tilly said at once. Her eyes were lustrous with fear and excitement, and she licked her lips obsessively.
"So you did, many and many a time. I'll set my watch and ward on it."
"So you might if you could reach up your fat ass far enough to find them," TikTok said. "Bring me my knife, Brandon, and mind you wipe that slut stink off it before you put it in my hand."
A short, bandy-legged man hopped to do as he had been bidden. The knife wouldn't come free at first. It seemed caught on the unfortunate dark-haired woman's breastbone. Brandon threw a terrified glance over his shoulder at the TikTok man and then tugged harder. TikTok, however, appeared to have forgotten all about both Brandon and the woman who had literally laughed herself to death. His brilliant green eyes had fixed on something which interested him much more than the dead woman.
"Come here, Cully," he said. "I want a better look at you."
Gasher gave him a shove. Jake stumbled forward. He would have fallen if TikTok's strong hands hadn't caught him by the shoulders. Then, when he was sure Jake had his balance again, TikTok grasped the boy's left wrist and raised it. It was Jake's Seiko which had drawn his interest.
"If this here's what I think it is, it's an omen for sure and true," TikTok said. "Talk to me, boy. What's this sigil you wear?"
Jake, who hadn't the slightest idea what a sigil was, could only hope for the best.
"It's a watch. But it doesn't work, Mr. TikTok."
Hoots chuckled at that, then clapped both hands over his mouth when the TikTok man turned to look at him. After a moment, TikTok looked back at Jake, and a sunny smile replaced the frown. Looking at that smile almost made you forget that it was a dead woman and not a movie Mexican taking a siesta over there against the wall. Looking at it almost made you forget that these people were crazy, and the TikTok man was likely the craziest inmate in the whole asylum.
"Watch," TikTok said, nodding. "Aye, a likely enough name for such. After all, what does a person want with a timepiece but to watch it once in a while? I, Brandon, I, Tilly, I, Gasher."
They responded with eager affirmatives. The TikTok man favored them with his winning smile, then turned back to Jake again. Now Jake noticed that the smile, winning or not, stopped well short of the TikTok man's green eyes. They were as they had been throughout, cool, cruel, and curious. He reached a finger toward the Seiko, which now proclaimed the time to be 91 minutes past 7, a.m. and p.m., and pulled it back just before touching the glass above the liquid crystal display.
"Tell me, dear boy, is this watch of yours booby-rigged?"
"Huh? Oh, no. No, it's not booby-rigged."
Jake touched his own finger to the face of the watch.
"That means nothing if it's set to the frequency of your own body," the TikTok man said.
He spoke in the sharp, scornful tone Jake's father used when he didn't want people to figure out that he didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about. TikTok glanced briefly at Brandon, and Jake saw him weigh the pros and cons of making the bow-legged man his designated toucher. Then he dismissed the notion and looked back into Jake's eyes.
"If this thing gives me a shock, my little friend, you're going to be choking to death on your own sweetmeats in 30 seconds.
Jake swallowed hard, but said nothing. The TikTok man reached out his finger again, and this time allowed it to settle on the face of the Seiko. The moment that it did, all the numbers went to zeros and then began to count upward again. TikTok's eyes had narrowed in a grimace of potential pain as he touched the face of the watch. Now their corners crinkled in the first genuine smile Jake had seen from him. He thought it was partly pleasure at his own courage, but mostly simple wonder and interest.
"May I have it?" he asked Jake silkily, as a gesture of your goodwill, shall we say.
I am something of a clock fancier, my dear young collie, so I am.
Be my guest. Jake stripped the watch off his arm at once and dropped it onto the TikTok man's large, waiting palm.
Talks just like a little silk-arsed gentleman, don't he? Gasher said happily. In old days, someone would have paid a very high price for the returner such as him, Tiki. Ah, so they would. Why, my father, your father, died so blowed out rotten with the mandrus that not even the dogs would eat him, the TikTok man interrupted. Now shut up, you idiot.
At first, Gasher looked furious, and then only abashed. He sank into a nearby chair and closed his mouth. TikTok, meanwhile, was examining the Seiko's expansion band with an expression of awe. He pulled it wide, let it snap back, pulled it wide again, let it snap back again. He dropped a lock of his hair into the open links, then laughed when they closed on it. At last he slipped the watch over his hand and pushed it halfway up his forearm. Jake thought this souvenir of New York looked very strange there, but said nothing.
Wonderful! TikTok exclaimed. Where did you get it, Cully?
It was a birthday present for my father and mother, Jake said. Gasher leaned forward at this, perhaps wanting to mention the idea of ransom again. If so, the intent look on the TikTok man's face changed his mind, and he sat back without saying anything.
Was it? TikTok marveled, raising his eyebrows.
He had discovered the small button which lit the face of the watch and kept pushing it, watching the light go off and on. Then he looked back at Jake, and his eyes were narrowed to bright green slits again.
Tell me something, Cully. Does this run on a dipolar or unipolar circuit?
Neither one, Jake said, not knowing that his failure to say he did not know what either of these terms meant was buying him a great deal of future trouble.
It runs on a nickel-cadmium battery. At least, I'm pretty sure it does. I've never had to replace it, and I lost the instruction folder a long time ago.
The TikTok man looked at him for a long time without speaking, and Jake realized with dismay that the blonde man was trying to decide if Jake had been making fun of him. If he decided Jake had been making fun, Jake had an idea that the abuse he had suffered on the way here would seem like tickling compared to what the TikTok man might do. He suddenly wanted to divert TikTok's train of thought, wanted that more than anything in the world. He said the first thing he thought might turn the trick.
He was your grandfather, wasn't he?
The TikTok man raised his brows interrogatively. His hands returned to Jake's shoulders, and although his grip was not tight, Jake could feel the phenomenal strength there. If TikTok chose to tighten his grip and pull sharply forward, he would snap Jake's collarbones like pencils. If he shoved, he would probably break his back.
Who was my grandfather, Cully?
Jake's eyes once more took in the TikTok man's massive, nobly shaped head and broad shoulders. He remembered what Susanna had said. Look at the size of him, Roland. They must have had to grease him to get him into the cockpit.
The man in the airplane. David Quick.
The TikTok man's eyes widened in surprise and amazement. Then he threw back his head and roared out a gust of laughter that echoed off the domed ceiling high above. The others smiled nervously. None, however, dared to laugh right out loud, not after what had happened to the woman with the dark hair.
"Whoever you are and wherever you come from, boy, you're the triggest cove old TikTok's run into for many a year. Quick was my great-grandfather, not my grandfather, but you're close enough. Wouldn't you say so, Gasher, my dear?" "Aye," Gasher said. "He's trig right enough. I could have told you that, but we're pert all the same."
"Yes," the TikTok man said thoughtfully. His hands tightened on the boy's shoulders and drew Jake closer to that smiling, handsome, lunatic face.
"I can see he's pert. It's in his eyes. But we'll take care of that, won't we, Gasher?"
It's not Gasher he's talking to, Jake thought. It's me. He thinks he's hypnotizing me.
And maybe he is.
Aye, Gasher breathed.
Jake felt he was drowning in those wide green eyes. Although the TikTok man's grip was still not really tight, he couldn't get enough breath into his lungs.
He summoned all of his own force in an effort to break the blond man's hold over him, and again spoke the first words which came to mind.
"So fell Lord Perth, and the countryside did shake with that thunder."
It acted upon TikTok like a hard, open-handed blow to the face. He recoiled, green eyes narrowing, his grip on Jake's shoulders tightening painfully.
"What do you say? Where did you hear that?"
"A little bird told me,"
Jake replied with calculated insolence, and the next instant he was flying across the room. If he had struck the curved wall head first, he would have been knocked cold or killed. As it happened, he struck on one hip, rebounded, and landed in a heap on the iron grillwork. He shook his head groggily, looked around, and found himself face to face with the woman who was not taking a siesta. He uttered a shocked cry and crawled away on his hands and knees. Hoots kicked him in the chest, flipping him onto his back. Jake lay there, gasping, looking up at the knot of rainbow colors where the neon tubes came together. A moment later, TikTok's face filled his field of vision. The man's lips were pressed together in a hard, straight line, his cheeks flared with color, and there was fear in his eyes. The coffin-shaped glass ornament he wore around his neck dangled directly in front of Jake's eyes, swinging gently back and forth on its silver chain, as if imitating the pendulum of the tiny grandfather clock inside.
"Gasher's right," he said.
He gathered a handful of Jake's shirt into one fist and pulled him up.
"You're pert. But you don't want to be pert with me, Cully. You don't ever want to be pert with me. Have you heard of people with short fuses? Well, I have no fuse at all. And there's a good 1,000 could testify to it if I hadn't stilled their tongues for good. If you ever speak to me of Lord Perth again, ever, 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 I'll tear off the top of your skull and eat your brains. I'll have none of that bad luck story in the Cradle of the Greys. Do you understand me?"
He shook Jake back and forth like a rag, and the boy burst into tears.
"Do you?"
"Yes."
"Good."
He set Jake upon his feet, where he swayed woozily back and forth, wiping at his streaming eyes and leaving smudges of dirt on his cheeks so dark they looked like mascara.
"Now, my little cull, we're going to have a question and answer session here. I'll ask the questions and you'll give the answers. Do you understand?"
Jake didn't reply. He was looking at a panel of the ventilator grill which circled the chamber. The TikTok man grabbed his nose between two of his fingers and squeezed it viciously.
"Do you understand me?"
"Yes,"
Jake cried. His eyes, now watering with pain as well as terror, returned to TikTok's face. He wanted to look back at the ventilator grill, wanted desperately to verify that what he had seen there was not simply a trick of his frightened, overloaded mind, but he didn't dare. He was afraid someone else, TikTok himself, most likely, would follow his gaze and see what he had seen.